Fresh Air Community Radio.
That's KFAA 90.3 FM in Minneapolis and St. Paul, or online at kfaa.org.
Well, you are.
Yeah, I knew that.
The viewpoints expressed in this program are the opinions of the people expressing them and are not necessarily those of Fresh Air Incorporated, its staff, or its board of directors.
Looking out on the morning rain, I used to feel so uninspired.
You are listening to Fresh Air Radio, KFAI 90.3 FM Minneapolis and 106.7 in St. Paul. This is Health Notes from the Hearts of a Natural Woman.
This program will inspire you, inform you, feed you healthy recipes, engage you politically, enlighten you spiritually.
Help me name it. I'm no longer doubtful of what I'm living for. And if I make you happy, I don't need to do more. Cause you make me feel.
Seriously, do you need another reason to get up and move? If preventing diabetes, colon cancer, heart disease, stroke, and obesity isn't enough, maybe, just maybe, Grim Reaper might convince you. That's right. Research now suggests that sitting on your duff shortens your lifespan. The researcher is quick to point out that sitting is a risk factor for morbidity, not a disease itself. The researcher from Pennington Biomedical Research Center at Louisiana State University states that sitting too much is comparable to obesity and is almost as bad as smoking. The researchers of this study pulled data that involved nearly 167,000 adults. They used a population attributable fraction, or PAF, to estimate and measure theoretical effects of how sitting would affect an entire population. They used three factors to calculate the number of deaths associated with sitting down. Their calculations suggest that sitting less than 3 hours per day could add 2 more years to your life. They also suggest that cutting television viewing to less than 2 hours each day could lead to a 1.38-year gain in lifespan. Other research points that Americans sit 55% of their day. This is well over the 3 hours suggested by this recent research. Other research has suggested that 92,000 cases of cancer each year could have been avoided if inactivity would have been avoided. Another research article suggests that people who sit for 11 hours or more were 40% more likely to die from any cause compared to those who were more active. There you have it, as if you needed another reason to go to the gym. Heck, forget the gym. Now you have another reason to simply get off the couch and go for a walk with a friend. I often suggest people who sit for their jobs never go more than an hour without taking a break to take a 5-minute walk down the halls or up and down the stairs at their job. You will have more energy, be more productive, and now studies show you will live longer. This has been a Health Note brought to you by Dr. Jonathan Arnold of Arnold Chiropractic and Acupuncture.
Good evening. You're listening to Fresh Air Community Radio, KFAI, 90.3 FM in Minneapolis, and we're streaming online at kfai.org. And this is Health Notes from the Hearts of a Natural Woman, and I'm Kinshasha. We are talking with Dr. Todd Pesek. We're talking about his new book, Eat Yourself Super, One Bite at a Time, A Superfood's Journey for the Happy, Healthy, and Hungry. Good evening, Dr. Todd. How are you?
I'm quite well. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for this important book. How did it come about?
That's a great question. There's a tremendous need for me to have something to hand out to my patients and students. I felt like I was saying the same thing over and over and over. Finally, I had several people say, well, you should just write a book, you know, and I said, yeah, I know. I've been thinking about it, and finally I just did it. I'm really glad because it's helping out a lot.
Is the medical community beginning to understand the importance of nutrition and wellness? Is that maybe a revolution that might be happening, I hope, as it relates to the medical community?
Well, the medical community on whole is kind of like, the analogy I draw is like the Titanic, you know, it's this huge thing that turns very slowly, right? What's really empowering people is their own personal conscious choices. And really, if you look at healthcare in general, 80% of the world's population rely on traditional health and wellness practices for primary health care. And the other 20%, that's the developed world, you know, America included, is really heading back to those roots in health and wellness through greater educational dissemination of these facts and things like that. I tell everybody, I'm an Appalachian root doctor who went to medical school. What that means really is that I grew up traditionally on a self-sustaining farm in rural Appalachia and learning traditional Appalachian root doctoring. I'm a fourth generation herbalist. I use those principles that have been imparting health and wellness via my ancestors for millennia. This isn't something new. What is new is modern medicine. It's only a few hundred years old. And with the amount of modern medical interventions and modern medicine, one would think that health and wellness is improving. And it actually isn't. It's the opposite is happening. And I think people are now saying, well, okay, this is ridiculous. What do I need to do? Take my health into my own hands? And how do I stay well in spite of my doctor, kind of a thing?
You start your book out by talking about diseases of civilization. Can you share some of that with us?
As a preface, the framework of the whole book is set up on my Secrets of Long Life research. So for the better part of the last two decades, I've been traveling around the world learning from elders and elders' elders, centenarians, 100-year-old, even super centenarians. What are your secrets of long life? And what are the traditional practices that imbue longevity and vital living? And suffice to say, you know, they're not secrets, right? They're a relatively simple set of practices that are embraced cross-culturally among our longest-lived elders. In a nutshell, really, the standard American diet, the Western diet, is what's driving all of these diseases, the diseases of civilization. Basically, for the first time in the history of humanity, people are eating plenty but starving. And there's no food in the food. We are eating calorie-rich but nutrient-sparse foods. And the reason that's a problem is because our bodies become satiated with nutrients. So if there's no food in the food, no nutrients with those calories, then the body continues to eat. It continues to overeat. This is the exact opposite of what the longest-lived elders do. They subsist on a plant-based, calorie-sparse, nutrient-rich diet that is there for health empowering. And so this relative overconsumption of calories relative to nutrients drives the disease of civilization. The majority of morbidity or disease simply need not exist. Atherosclerosis, which leads to coronary artery disease and then heart attacks and stroke, is simply put fat toxicity. It's just, you know, an overconsumption of fat, and very similarly, an overconsumption of sugar or sugar toxicity drives diabetes. Those two disease states actually drive the gamut of the diseases of civilization and inflammation, which is also underpins both of those ailments as well as many others, including cancer. So you see these longest-lived elders in these cultures that eat traditionally the plant-based, calorie-sparse, nutrient-rich, diets like our longest-lived elders, you see that those diseases just are non-existent. The atherosclerosis and the coronary artery disease and the diabetes and the cancers even.
We're talking this evening with Dr. Todd Pesek. We're talking about his important book, Eat Yourself Super, One Bite at a Time, Superfoods Journey for the Happy, Healthy, and Hungry. Share with us, Dr. Todd, what is a superfood?
A superfood is a plant-based, calorie-sparse, nutrient-rich food. And because of those qualities, it is health empowering.
The thing that's really interesting about what you're talking about, and you said it several times since we started talking, is that it is just the opposite of the way that most Americans eat, and certainly in terms of a high calorie, high cooked, high meat diet is what we do and what we're addicted to. How do we make that shift from that kind of diet to the kind, to the superfood diet that you're talking about? I mean, we're addicts, Doc.
That's a great question. And I'll first say that it's really easy. And I'll also say that, unfortunately but true, interested business plays way too prominent a role in the standard of care medicine in our country. And also, interested business plays way too prominent a role in food supply and what types of foods are available. We're told every second of every day what to eat, what to buy, what's beautiful, what isn't. 95% of humanity subsists on five plants: corn, rice, wheat, soy, and barley. The global rights to those few plants are owned by a few companies. That's why that happens. And those plants are cereals aside from soy, and they drive inflammation because of that. So with a global disease burden rooted in inflammation, it seems unfortunate but true that people are consuming foods that drive inflammation. Now, there are 400,000 species of plants out there, many of which are edible. So the trick then becomes eating some of those plants instead of some of these few five. And I'm not saying that you have to cut the cereals out of your diet, but there are ways to consume them more healthfully and in balance with foods that don't drive inflammation. To teach people how easily to begin this, I designed the superfoods pyramid, Dr. Todd's superfoods pyramid, which is basically a stepwise pyramid starting from the bottom up that teaches proportions and amounts of foods to consume. The base of the pyramid are green leaves, calorie for calorie, ounce for ounce. They are the most nutritive food in existence and the staple of the superfoods diet. Our ancestors in season ate several pounds of green leaves a day. One of the things that I tell people is that you honor your body and meet yourself where you're willing to be met. You don't want to cut out all your comfort foods and give up on this. You want to start slow. Start with greens. Start with greens with every meal, and then make greens the meal, and then you'll continue on the path and make sustainable changes that are long-term.
You know, an important belief that many Americans have is that in order to be healthy, we have to have high levels of protein, and that protein comes in the form of animal protein. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's misinformation that's delivered really from interested business. So first of all, generally speaking, people eat way too much protein, right? Our traditional diet, our ancestral diet, was principally carbohydrates with small amounts of protein and small amounts of fat. That's the healthy diet. We need that for healthy cognitive functioning, a state of inflammatory balance. I think the animal-based proteins, because what happens here is not only are people eating those five plants, corn, rice, wheat, soy, and barley, they're actually feeding those to the animals and then eating the animals. So the animals are perpetually pro-inflamed from all of those cereals. It just continues to drive disease. So the animal proteins raise uric acid levels in the body and are pretty much acidic. They're hard for people to digest and deal with. And that really contributes largely to the state of inflammatory balance. I have a thriving practice in northeastern Ohio where I don't use drugs. I use foods. I use the correct foods and herbs to treat people. And one of the first things I do in addition to superfoods is tell them to minimize and think about redesigning your daily plate. If you must include animal and animal protein, they should be a small portion of that. But make no mistake, the gold standard in health is a plant-based, low-fat diet. Make no mistake that the longest-lived elders the world over demonstrate that a diet rich in superfoods promotes longevity and well-being.
I made it through the wilderness. Somehow I made it through. I didn't know how lost I was till I found you. I was being incomplete. I'd been had, I was sad and blue, but you made me feel, yeah, you made me feel, I was shiny and new.
To my KFAI invites you to join us for the 23rd annual Balkanicus concert.
Artsy and avant-garde, emotional, upbeat, and irregular. And at the end of it, meet performers and fellow music lovers over a tasty Mediterranean reception, featuring music from Albanian, Bulgarian, and Serbian composers. All the pieces are American premieres, and as always, Balkanicus will premiere a piece new to the world. Saturday, April 25th at 7 p.m. at Alton Recital Hall on the U of M West Bank campus. Free and open to the public. All are welcome. If you have never experienced this music before, here's your opportunity to join us.
Visit kfai.org/Balkan for more details.
We're talking about superfoods this evening on Health Notes. Eat yourself super, one bite at a time. Dr. Todd Pesek is our guest this evening. And where does water fit into this conversation, Dr. Todd?
That's an awesome question, right? Because of who I am and the way I was raised, I view water very, very differently than most. Water is a miraculous being, and it's a living liquid crystal with information and healing, rejuvenating properties about it. I can't even tell you how many times a patient has said to me when I've said, you need to drink more water. They've said, well, I don't like water. I drink this instead. And I tell them, you know, empathetically, you can't hate water. I understand where you're coming from on this. You know, the water that they've developed the distaste for is tap water. And unfortunate but true, our water supply is becoming more and more polluted with heavy metals, plastics, endocrine disruptors, even pharmaceutical drugs. And I think that, you know, this is a fundamental question that we really need to address as a global people. The world's children don't need global campaigns for vaccination. They need global campaigns for clean water. And we need to continue to do this in strong order as a priority, in my view. So what I tell people is the best water you could drink is spring water right from the earth. And the next best is make sure that you know the kind of toxins in your water and filter for them appropriately. The Environmental Working Group did a great database project where you could go to their website, and all this is in my book. You go to their website and you type in your zip code, and it tells you what kind of toxins are in your water and what kind of filters you need to remove them. For the most part, reverse osmosis is the best, but it takes the good stuff out too in terms of filtration. So my water hierarchy is good old-fashioned spring water bubbling right up from the earth that our ancestors had imbibed in. And then the next best is reverse osmosis filtered water. But it depends on your region. And I tell everybody to really get connected to water and learn about water and your water supply and what you need to do to ensure clean water and health. Because most people are chronically dehydrated, and make sure that you're not, right? And that goes for women in particular, because they are a little bit higher of a percentage of body fat relative to men. And adipose tissue or fat tissue, it's kind of dehydrated to start with. So it's something that we all need to pay very close attention to and really deal with. And make your water and your water selection and water consumption a ritual. Connect your children to it, is what I tell people.
You say that we should eat the rainbow every day.
Absolutely. It doesn't matter if you know about the carotenoids or the zeaxanthins or the luteins or the indoles. All it really matters is the Roy G. Biv, red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, violet. Consuming the rainbow does is it ensures a diet diverse in phytochemicals and plant pigments that our bodies are dependent on for health. Lots and lots of different reasons. They're chemoprotective against cancers, and they're antioxidant rich. They're nutritive. They're alkalinizing. Chlorophylls are crucially important for our health. bodies from the damaging oxidants in the environment and all kinds of things.
When we're talking about eating with the rainbow, can you give us some ideas of what that looks like? What would a plate that is rainbow filled look like, for example?
The superfoods pyramid, it kind of starts out with the base. The base of the superfoods pyramid are green leaves, and then one up rainbow veggies. Rainbow fruits is above the rainbow veggies because you want to kind of have about two-thirds as many veggies or twice as many veggies as you do fruits. On any plate, you'd want to have proportionally, you know, a big pile of greens, maybe a couple of different colors of your veggies. And what I do is I tend to make large salads and things like that, and you could have all of them mixed in one. You could have rainbow slaw, which is a recipe in my book, and there's a lot of different ways of creatively incorporating all of those different colors. But the majority is going to be green, and then you're going to have roughly twice as many vegetables as fruits. Fruits are important, too, for a lot of different reasons. And I'm a big advocate of berries, you know, blueberries in particular. I think blueberries are actually not only antioxidant-rich and nutritive powerhouses, but they're actually help work against sugar toxicity and glycation end products that drive the complications of diabetes and things like that. So they're really important.
We're talking about superfoods this evening on Health Notes. Eat yourself super, one bite at a time. Dr. Todd Pesek is our guest. And another issue that is pretty important to anyone who is nutrition conscious is the omegas. And certainly the information that we have been told is that the only way that we can get the omegas is through fish. Can you walk us through the omegas?
Absolutely. Yeah, and that is not true. The fish get their omega-3 fats from algae. That's where we should get it. Our ancestors ate, you know, tremendous amounts of algae and seaweeds and root vegetables that concentrate these kind of things. And there are omegas in greens. Here's the deal. You've heard essential fatty acids, 369, 369, 369. Well, they're essential because our bodies can't make them, right? So you have to take them in from through the diet. The nines we can make from the threes and the sixes. So really the two essential are the threes and the sixes. Though essential, they have drastically different functions in the human body. Before I continue there, I'll mention inflammation again. Inflammation is not a disease. It's a physiologic process that we need to heal ourselves. The problem arises with inflammation when it's chronic, and there's this chronic inflammatory burden in the body. And so the omega-3s and the omega-6s, though essential, they have drastically different functions in the human body. The omega-3s are metabolized to EPA and DHA, which are longer-chain omega-3 fats that are anti-inflammatory in the body. The 6s, on the other hand, are metabolized into things that drive inflammation. So the 3s are anti-inflammatory. The 6s are pro-inflammatory. And remember, we need our inflammatory cascades to be in a state of balance. There needs to be anti-inflammatory balance to the inflammation. Our ancestors ate these 3s to 6s on a relatively equal ratio. But nowadays, because of the standard American diet, or the hereafter referred to as the SAD, we're consuming 3s to 6s more along a ratio of like 1 to 30, 20 or even 30, right? So that's a problem because the food choices are driving inflammation and driving disease. 95% of humanity that subsists on these 5 cereal grains that drive inflammation are relatively low in omega-3 but rich in omega-6. And, you know, that's what drives this whole omega-3 to 6 imbalance in our diets and our food supply and things like that. So I tell people, moral of the story, is eat more 3s, less 6s. And the best sources of threes because they occur in things together. But the foods that have lots of threes and a little bit of six are the ones that I advocate for, and that's chia seeds, flax seeds, walnuts, sacha inchi seeds, and a few other things like that. But also just your basic greens. Eat the greens. Eat the greens, the G of the rainbow.
What about vitamin D?
Vitamin D is, well, first of all, it's not a vitamin. It's a hormone. The difference is a vitamin you get from your food, from your diet. A hormone is made inside of your body. And vitamin D is made when ultraviolet B radiation from the sun hits our skin. The father of all hormones, vitamin D included, is cholesterol, which has been unnecessarily vilified in our culture and by the media. We need cholesterol for health. Our bodies make it, though. When you're exposed to boatloads of exogenous cholesterol in your diet, then it becomes an issue. But your body needs cholesterol to produce all of its hormones of longevity and vital living, and that includes vitamin D. And vitamin D is classically ascribed the benefit of calcium absorption, right? So you could eat calcium until literally the cows come home and not absorb it if you don't have vitamin D. So I think it's ridiculous. And by the way, there's more calcium in chia seeds than there is in milk. I do not advocate for dairy. I believe that dairy products drive inflammation, you know? So the gold standard diet in health and wellness is a plant-based, low-fat diet, and the animal products need to be minimized or eliminated as junk food. There's no question. So vitamin D, though, is above and beyond that classic vitamin D role of calcium absorption, is responsible for pretty much the epigenetic regulation of about 15% of your genome. So it's got its hand in pretty much everything of your physiology, right? On optimized vitamin D levels, you see risk reductions for cancer go down like 77%, breast cancer is 83%, diabetes type 1 even, which is an inflammatory condition, 60%, MS similar to that, heart attacks, 30%. It's just, the list goes on and on. And the fact that people are walking around with vitamin D deficiencies and being diagnosed with osteopenia and osteoporosis is just, it's very sad. Vitamin D repletion should be at the top of pretty much every treatment paradigm in medicine. And if somebody is vitamin D deficient, they should have that corrected as soon as possible.
And from what I understand, don't most Americans, aren't we as deficient in vitamin D as we are dehydrated? Especially those of us who live in areas like Minnesota.
Well, it's true that there are regional differences and things like that. But even to confound that, there are skin tone differences. You know, the darker the skin tone, the longer that person needs to be out exposed to sunshine to synthesize the correct amounts of vitamin D. On that note, the woefully inadequate conventional medical recommendations of like a few thousand IUs here and there, it just doesn't do it. 20 minutes out in the sun, your body synthesizes between 20 and 30,000 IUs of vitamin D. You know, multiply that out the entire day, you're producing 500,000 to 1,000,000 IUs. We've gotten from the media over the course of our lives, we've been misled in a number of respects. Always remember that it starts right now, and your health is never stagnant. It's either getting better or worse based on the habits that you have. So start small and start implementing the good habits and see how great you feel. And the book is an excellent tool. You want to eat from the superfoods pyramid, eat the rainbow. You want to supplement where necessary. You know, start with the greens. Start with the greens. Remember, make no mistake, the two most single important determinants in longevity and vital living are walking. The longer you walk, the longer you'll live. And calories, calorie-restrictive diets, and not painfully calorie-restrictive. You want to have the kind of diet that you're satiated on with nutrients. You know, like your body has what it needs, so you're not hungry. That's the way to be satiated. So I have an informative website. It's www.eatyourselfsuper.com, and there's a blog on that website. I guess I'd leave you with that.
Dr. Todd Pesek, Eat Yourself Super, one bite at a time. Thank you so much for the work, Doctor. I appreciate it a lot.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me. It's been an honor. If there's anything more I could do for you, I'd be happy.
Thank you, Doctor. Have a great day.
Be well.
Bye-bye. Dr. Nina Shapiro, her new book, Take a Deep Breath, Clear the Air for the Health of Your Child. You know, I was fascinated as I was reading your book, as I didn't understand that there was a difference in breathing patterns from one age to the next. Why is it important that we understand what's going on with our children's breath and how they're breathing from one stage to the next?
Well, I think it's a very important problem because part of the issue is that at different ages, kids, babies, newborns breathe at different rates, and adults too. So babies, you think of them sort of like a little bird, their normal breathing pattern or how fast they breathe is going to be much faster than an older child or an adult. So if you see a baby or a newborn breathing what seems to be quickly, it may actually be normal. I think the other issue that you bring up is that infants, newborns, and then older kids have different physical structures. Even though they're the same human that they were right when they were born, their anatomy develops so differently as they age, and they encounter different problems based on their ages.
So is it normal for young children to snore?
All children have some degree of snoring at some point during their childhood. And yes, this is normal. But what I talk about a lot in the book is that snoring, where you can hear it in the next room, it's every night to the point where your child seems to be struggling at night. If you hear loud snoring followed by a silence, followed by a gasp or a cough, then that indicates that your child may have something called sleep apnea, which in children is not normal. So a little bit of noise is okay, snoring is okay, but anything where it's really loud, then that needs to be addressed.
So if your child isn't sleep apnea usually associated with obesity?
Sleep apnea used to be only associated with obesity. It used to be associated with older adults. But sleep apnea can be a problem in infants or children. And it's not necessarily secondary to obesity. A lot of these children who have sleep apnea are actually underweight. The reason that they're having sleep apnea most commonly is because they have big tonsils and big adenoids, which are structures in the back of the mouth and the back of the nose. And if these are too big, they can block the child's breathing. So some of these kids are underweight. Some of these kids are overweight or obese, but that's not necessarily the cause of the sleep apnea.
So in sleep apnea, a child is, they're not breathing at some point, and then they catch up with their breath. Is that connected to sudden infant death syndrome?
Usually not. Sudden infant death syndrome, as the term applies, is usually seen during the newborn period. The highest risk is usually up to age 5 months. The reason we think that a lot of babies suffer from sudden infant death syndrome is if they are positioned in a way, say face down on a mattress or covered with a blanket, that they can rebreathe their own carbon dioxide that they breathe out. And this puts them in a sleep phase that's much too deep, unable to wake themselves up. and they get into this phase where they stop breathing. So sudden infant death syndrome can be caused by apnea, which really means that they're stopping breathing. But the sleep apnea that we see in older kids and toddlers is a little bit different.
Support comes from YWCA Minneapolis, providing early childhood education for infants, toddlers, and preschoolers in the Twin Cities. For more than 50 years, YWCA Minneapolis has helped children build confidence, make friends, and develop a love of learning in classrooms, where every child feels welcomed, supported, and valued. Learn more at ywcampls.org.
We're talking about the new book, Take a Deep Breath. Dr. Nina Shapiro is our guest this evening on Health Notes, and it's when we think about our children and colds, colds are pretty happenstance with our kids. Is there a time that a cold is more than a cold?
So you're exactly right. Colds are very common in kids, and young kids, and by that I mean sort of the toddler, preschool-age kids, can get 5 to 10 colds per year. And then if they have a sibling, they can get another 5 to 10 colds per year, plus the parents are getting colds. So it usually seems in many households as if somebody is sick all the time, and this is really okay. When we start to worry about a child having something that's more than a cold, is a cold, for instance, that doesn't go away in the usual 3 to 5 day period, a child that seems that they have a fever that doesn't come down, they just don't seem right, they're not eating well, they're not sleeping well, it's really, really slowing them down. They may have some other signs like a deep cough or any trouble breathing. In those situations, then you need to have your doctor take a look to see if it is more than a cold. It can be something like a sinus infection, an ear infection, bronchitis, or even pneumonia. And what I always tell parents is that if your child has a cold but they just don't seem right and you're not even sure what that is, even if you're not sure what's wrong, that's reason enough to bring your child in to be checked.
Hmm. Wow, we're talking about breathing issues with our children this evening on Health Notes, the new book, Take a Deep Breath. And Dr. Nina Shapiro, is our guest and author. And when I'm thinking about breathing issues, the breathing patterns of newborns is such an interesting pattern. Can you share with us what is a normal breathing pattern for a newborn?
Well, newborns breathe, and again, another thing just to bring up is that even in newborns, you should not hear them breathing. Breathing should be silent. It should be something that you see, but that you don't necessarily hear. But the difference is that newborns breathe quite rapidly. They have very tiny lungs, and they breathe very shallow breaths, and this breathing rate can be anywhere from 25 to 40 breaths per minute, so almost one breath per second, whereas an adult can breathe anywhere from 12 to 15 or 20 times per minute, so almost half as much frequency of breathing. So newborns breathe quite rapidly, and this is normal. You do see a newborn who's breathing faster than that, where they're closer to every second, which would be about 50 to 60 times per minute. That's when you may be concerned that there's a problem. But normally, newborns breathe quite quickly.
Hmm. And if we do hear their breathing, we should bring them into the doctor?
Yes. If there's a sudden change in their breathing, then you should bring them into the doctor or even the emergency room right away. But if it's a gradual change, say over days to weeks, where you start to notice more noise in their breathing that comes and goes, then it's not necessarily an emergency, but they definitely need to be checked.
And how does that breathing pattern change as the newborn becomes a toddler?
So as newborns age, their lungs get bigger, their windpipe gets bigger, their brain gets bigger, and with all of that, their breathing slows a little bit. Certainly if a toddler is running around, their breathing rate is going to go up significantly. But in general, toddlers breathe more slowly than newborns. So they may breathe, instead of 40 times per minute, they may breathe 25 to 30 times per minute. So their breathing rate slows. But again, a toddler's breathing should be silent, just as a newborn's breathing should be silent. You should not hear them. If you hear any sort of noise, if it's sudden, they need to come into the emergency room or go to see the doctor right away. If it's a gradual change or some sort of change that comes and goes, then that may just warrant a phone call to your doctor.
And so as our children get older, with each age, does their breathing slow down a little more?
As you get older, your breathing slows. And the other thing to just remember is that however quickly or at whatever rate an infant or a newborn or a toddler is breathing during the day, that rate of breathing, and this goes for adults as well, slows significantly during sleep. So a toddler may breathe 30 times per minute when they're awake, but they may breathe 20 times per minute when they're asleep. So all of that rate, just as your brain relaxes and your body relaxes, your breathing rate slows down as well.
Boy, there's just so many questions. We're talking about the new book, Take a Deep Breath, Clear the Air for the Health of Your Child. Dr. Nina Shapiro is our guest this evening on Health Notes. And what are the signs that my child needs his tonsils or their adenoids taken out?
Well, most commonly these days, we know that tonsils and adenoids don't need to absolutely be removed in every child. But things that we look for and signs that may indicate that your child would need their tonsils or adenoids out primarily are breathing problems. And those sort of problems we see at nighttime: loud snoring, gasping at night, difficulty with sleep, tossing and turning. Anytime if you notice your child take a big gasp, there's silence followed by a cough or a loud snore, then your child needs to be checked, because most commonly the reason for breathing problems at night, which would be snoring or sleep apnea, most commonly in kids is due to their large tonsils and adenoids.
Isn't that interesting? And when I'm thinking about problems in the areas that we're talking about, I'm wondering about ear problems. And it seems that between 0 and 3, that's an especially challenging time for young people and their ears. What's going on with that?
Well, ear infections, as you say, are very common. It's actually the most common reason that a child is brought to a doctor's appointment in this country is for an ear problem, an earache, an ear infection. And these are, you know, it's a real problem as far as the frequency of them in this country. And what's going on, why kids get a lot of ear infections, is the ears are actually connected to the back of the nose. So kids who get colds or stuffy noses, they're exposed to other kids, those colds usually go right to their ears. So a child who has a cold, cough, they may develop fluid, the same sort of fluid that's sitting in their nose may go to the back of their ear. It gets trapped in there, bacteria grow, and then the ear becomes infected. And ear infections are quite painful. For any parent who's had a child with an ear infection, you know that that child could be miserable. And it's all related, even though the ears you see on the outside of their bodies, the ears are actually part of the respiratory or breathing system. So it's all connected back to them.
So is it a given that children who recurringly have that problem need tubes in their ears in order to correct that problem?
You know, ear infections are very, again, I said they're very common. As far as whether your child needs ear tubes, there are some guidelines for that. Part of that has to do with how frequent their ear infections are. For instance, if they're getting an ear infection every month, and this is 6, 7, 8 months in a row, every month your child is getting an ear infection, and for 3, 4, 5, 6 days of every month your child is miserable, that may be a child who needs ear tubes. A child who has an ear infection, and then after the ear infection is gone, the fluid sticks around for 3-4 months, and it's starting to affect their hearing. That may be a child who needs ear tubes. A child who's had a few infections, if they have a few infections every year, they're treated, they get better, whether it's with antibiotics or just with time, that's not necessarily a child who needs ear tubes.
Can you talk to us about baby slings and carriers, and are they safe?
Sure, that's a great question, because there's so many different kinds of baby slings and carriers out there, and every year there are new designs fashioned and new structures fashioned, and I think they are wonderful. I think they are safe if they are used safely. As with anything, there are certainly dangers. There were some very, very serious concerns a few years ago, because there were several deaths of infants while they were in their baby carriers, likely due to a SIDS or a sudden infant death syndrome-like episode. So if you have a young infant, and by that I mean an infant under 4 months old, and they're in a baby sling, you need to be really careful about where their head is placed. They have a tiny little air passage. Babies under age 3 or 4 months have to breathe through their nose. You want to keep their nose open. You don't want to keep it compressed up against the fabric, up against your body. Their face and their nose need to be exposed to air. You also want to make sure that their neck is secure and it's not sort of flopped too forward or too far backwards. So I think baby slings are wonderful. You just need to use them safely. Check on your baby. Babies get great naps in these slings, but you want to make sure that your baby isn't having too deep a sleep, that they're getting compressed against the fabric. So I think if they're used safely, they are great, but you need to understand where your baby's space to be, and that is exposed to air.
What about young children and swimming pools and chlorine? How will that affect the respiratory system?
Well, I think chlorine is safe if it's used at the appropriate level. Chlorine can be quite toxic. So if there's too much chlorine, it can certainly burn the eyes and burn the nasal passages and cause some swelling. But chlorine is certainly in home pools as well as in public pools for a reason, and that is to keep the water clean. It prevents algae from developing. It prevents a lot of the bacteria and viruses from growing inside the pool water. So I think chlorine is actually a benefit as long as it's used safely.
What about sleeping with infants and toddlers? Is that a problem?
Well, I think if you're talking about co-sleeping, which means that your infant or your toddler is in your bed, certainly that's a personal decision, but people need to understand that newborns are at higher risk for sudden infant death syndrome if they are sleeping in a parent's bed. And that has been documented, that it is considered a risk factor for SIDS if your newborn is sleeping in your bed. The safest way for a newborn to sleep is on a firm crib mattress by themselves, with no toys, no blankets, no bumpers, no people in their crib. Once they're older and they're able to turn on their own and move on their own a little more independently, then I think co-sleeping is a personal choice, and some people swear by it, some people don't approve of it. But when it becomes a behavioral issue, I really leave that up to the parents. But from a safety issue, newborns are found to be much safer if they're in their own sleep space.
So, doctor, did you say no blankets as well?
Yes, no blankets. And there are very specific guidelines put out by the American Academy of Pediatrics as far as what's considered the safest way for a newborn to sleep. And the safest way is for them to sleep with absolutely nothing in the crib. Obviously, if you live in a cold climate, or most climates are, it's cold at night, so they can be bundled either in a sleep sack or in a wrap with comfortable pajamas, but they should not have a blanket, because infants can't control if the blanket accidentally covers their face. They may not have the wherewithal, the coordination, or even the brain function to know to move that blanket.
Wow. That's
It's not as pretty. You can have the blankets decorating the crib during the daytime, but once it's time for a nap or sleep, the crib should be absolutely empty.
Wow. We're talking about the new book, Take a Deep Breath. Dr. Nina Shapiro is our guest this evening. Dr. Shapiro, what's the difference between a runny nose and a stuffy nose?
Well, a runny nose, as the word implies, means that there's something coming out of the nose. Either it's usually mucus, and that could be clear, which is usually a sign of a mild cold or allergies. It could be darker colors, yellow, green, brown, which may be a sign of a bacterial infection, although not necessarily. A stuffy nose is where your child can't breathe through their nose, so there may be nothing coming out, and you may be encouraging your child to blow their nose, and nothing comes out, and that's because their nose is stuffed. Most common reasons for a stuffy nose can be a cold as well, could be allergies or enlarged adenoids, which are like a set of tonsil-type tissue, lymph node tissue that sits way in the back of the nose. If that's enlarged all the time, then your child may have a stuffy nose that's not necessarily a runny nose.
If my newborn, well, probably not the newborn, but if my toddler gets a toy or food stuck in their throat, the way that is there a particular safe way of being able to stop them from choking?
Well, usually kids are very fast, and starting at about age 10 months, that's the risky age for food and toy choking. These kids are very fast, they have very good eye-hand coordination, and they love to put things in their mouth. So all of that makes it very difficult to prevent them from doing this. The first thing you need to do is just to make sure that they are seated when they're eating, they're not running around when they're eating, that the toys that they're playing with are labeled age appropriate. They shouldn't be playing with toys with small parts. But if your child does, and this does happen, if they do put something in their mouth and they've choked on it, the first thing you need to do is watch them. If they seem to be coughing and crying, then their airflow is not completely blocked, and you should just let them cough and cry. If they have choked on something and they are not crying and there's no air moving, then the first thing you need to try, if it's a baby over 12 to 18 months, you can try the Heimlich maneuver, where you stand behind them and grasp their upper abdomen and give a few quick thrusts how to do this. And you should try that. You can also try some back thrusts where you kind of firmly pat them on the back to see if you can extract the item. If they start coughing and crying after that, then let them do so, because that means the object has been cleared. If they have not and they are not breathing, then, and this is, a horrible topic to talk about, but we need to mention this, is that you need to start CPR. If you do not know CPR, this is something that everyone needs to learn.
Wow. I'm wondering about indoor and outdoor pollution exposures in our children. What do we need to know? And what effect is that having on our children?
Well, I think this is one piece of good news. And the good news is that the air quality in the United States overall has improved significantly over the last 10 to 20 years. The Environmental Protection Agency has issued something called the Clean Air Act, and that has literally enabled us to clean up the environment as far as the outdoor air pollution. So all of the major pollutants in this country have reduced significantly since the late 1990s. So air quality outside, we're always concerned about this, it has improved significantly. So that's the good news. The other news is that global warming is still a little bit of an unknown as far as how that's affecting our respiratory system. It certainly can be associated with increased allergies. Pollen counts are higher than they were before global warming was a concern. Allergies are starting earlier every season, likely secondary to increased annual temperature. So that's a concern as far as the outdoor pollution. Indoor pollution, still the number one indoor pollutant is cigarette smoke. whether you smoke inside of the house or outside of the house, you are bringing toxins into your baby. So the number one way to reduce indoor pollution is to stop smoking.
I just found out I'm listening to Fresh Air Community Radio.
That's KFAI 90.3 FM in Minneapolis and St. Paul, and online at kfai.org.
And you're listening too.
I mean, this is not the kind of music that comes from Minneapolis, Minnesota.
No.
And you're living in Minneapolis, of all places.
Minneapolis, yeah. I will always live in Minneapolis.
You will always live there?
Mm-hmm.
Why?
It's so cold, it keeps the bad people out.
Thank you, Minneapolis. We love you. Do me a favor and take care of each other.